The bombshell public impeachment hearings started this week. What mattered and what comes next? Let's get on topic. Welcome to On Topic, a weekly in-depth look at a topic that helps us understand the week's news. My name's Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a CNN legal analyst. I'm usually joined by my friend Patty Vasquez, but she's still on the campaign trail this week, so I'm going to be bringing in our guest, Maya Wiley, in just a moment. But before I introduce her, I want to note that this episode is brought to you by our Patreons, with special thanks to Michelle Du, Eric DeWurst, Edie, James Frohmeyer, Jamie Gordon, Steve Hungsberg, and one anonymous patron. You can become a patron, too, on our website, ontopicpodcast.com, all one word. Just click the support link at the top of the page. So let's bring in our guest, Maya Wiley. You probably know her because she's a legal analyst on NBC News and MSNBC. But she's had a distinguished legal career. And in fact, she was the chief legal advisor for the New York City mayor. She's also now currently the senior vice president for social justice at the New School University. And she is also an expert on digital equity and co-directs their digital equity laboratory. So I am excited to speak with her. This is her first time on the podcast. So let's bring her in now. Welcome to the podcast, Maya. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Renato. It's great to be on.
Look, you and I have shared, I think, privately a lot of thoughts about the hearings this week. I'm curious, what is your, key reaction? This is, I think, quite a week, an important moment.
Oh, it was an incredibly powerful and disturbing week. Powerful because the witnesses themselves, I think, were so deeply committed to the country, to the Constitution, to their responsibility as public servants to be both fair, accurate, and factual and nonpartisan. And in doing so, it was so disturbing because, one, they listed every single fact we hadn't heard enough about around why this was such a significant national security concern, why what appears to be the president's direction to people who reported directly to him to help him get damaging material on the Bidens in exchange for both a critical meeting opportunity with the new president of Ukraine and also, of course, it appears military aid, that given the national security concerns, that use of presidential power was a significant abuse of authority and clearly an impeachable offense. And obviously, if we add, Maria Yovanovitch was both an incredibly calm, collected, and powerful witness. But to have to sit there in a public hearing in the U.S. Capitol and be told by the chair of the committee that the president is tweeting about you as you're sitting there trying to give honest testimony about your concerns about the national security of the country was just unspeakably astounding.
Yeah, I have to say, I feel like her testimony sort of is a good illustration of something that can be hard to explain to people who have never tried a case, which is that sometimes the importance of a witness goes beyond the power of their words. There's specific words that they say, right?
Yeah,
if you just like looked at these witnesses on paper, you'd be like, well, she wasn't talking to Donald Trump. She wasn't in the thick of this quid pro quo thing. So what value does she bring as a witness? And, you mentioned some of her qualities. I think she had a real quiet strength. She was a very formidable person. And she was also somebody who was harmed by Trump. And she wasn't like the victim of the quid pro quo scheme, whatever you want to call it, the Ukrainian scheme that you just laid out. But she was somebody who was deeply harmed by Trump, and she stood as a contrast to him. And I think that for people, there's a lot of people at home who are like, well, why do I care about this? Mm-hmm. And I think she helped answer that question a little bit.
I think you're right. And I think she did it in a way that Bill Taylor couldn't quite do, because, of course, a lot of the facts and the national security interests Bill Taylor also testified to. What made her so important, as you point out, Renato, I think rightly, is one, she was the first public servant victim, that she was the bellwether. It was Donald Trump turning on her personally, despite her stellar record as a public servant and the fact that she had just been asked to stay on another year by the State Department in the Ukraine as ambassador, because it was such an important and pivotal time to fight corruption in the Ukraine and defend the borders, right? Its territorial integrity, that in that moment, he turns on her. And that's when the red flags go up to others. Remember, Bill Taylor comes in just a few days after that, and Mike Pompeo personally asks Bill Taylor, please come and help us in Ukraine, essentially because Donald Trump just pushed their star diplomat out of the Ukraine on the eve of inauguration. So her telling that story, so, you know, we hear this from Bill Taylor. We know that his primary concern, having spoken to Maria Yovanovitch, knowing her personally, knowing her quality, was deeply concerned about whether he should do it. And she says, yes, do it. We need a strong, competent person in the Ukraine. So her telling the story on the stand about this historic inauguration of a new president who is going to stand up to the corruption Donald Trump says he was concerned about when he removed her and when he held up the aid, says that was his concern. Yet, well, I'm sorry, I don't know if he said it around removing her. He certainly said it around the foreign aid, but he hasn't actually ever answered the question why he removed such a star. But that story where she's just given an award posthumously to a woman who has fought corruption in the Ukraine, and it cost her her life. It cost her her life. And this is a hardship posting, and this is a career public servant who herself personally dodged bullets for the country. And Donald Trump tweets, you didn't do a good enough job dodging those bullets in Somalia, essentially. So you're right, because that I'm just agreeing with you, but it really were those moments, and then the juxtaposition of Donald Trump's excruciatingly intimidating and abusive behavior while she was on that stand, and that was something that Bill Taylor couldn't do because he was not the person who was in the midst of that level of attack and abuse, with the striking counterpart of her story about standing up to corruption and the costs of doing so.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, going into the day, I will confess to you, Maya, that I wasn't sure how much the public would be interested in the ambassador's testimony because, you know, a lot of times the news cycle is such that people are always looking for, well, how does this affect Trump? What does this mean? How does this move the ball forward? You know, it's all very, you know, X's and O's. And despite all of the things that she brings as a witness that go beyond what the testimony was, you know, to me, her value was that she told the story. She was kind of the starting person in the story, even aside from all of the strengths and the important things she brought to the table that we discussed earlier. But there's no question that Donald Trump ensured that she would not only be her testimony would dominate the news coverage, but that he created essentially a moment that I think will be remembered coming out of this impeachment inquiry, which, you know, of that tweet and her response to it. And I certainly give credit to Chairman Schiff in real time interrupting the staff attorney, Mr. Goldman, and asking the ambassador about that. But I also say she, you know, for someone who's reserved, you know, people who speak speak loosely and throw a lot of accusations around, let's say Rudy Giuliani, whenever they say something, they're kind of like the boy who cried wolf. You don't take it seriously. But given how careful and thoughtful and reasoned the ambassador's responses were, her saying that is very intimidating, I think carried a kind of a weight to it that it otherwise would not have carried if it was someone else.
Yes, completely agree. I mean, she had the ability to be calm and measured, and yet and honest. It was a very honest answer to say you're intimidated, particularly when you have, remember you had Hannity saying the night before, predicting she was going to break down and cry, as if that would be somehow a negative strike against her. I actually think under the circumstances, you know, any number of very, very strong people might cry, and we shouldn't celebrate that. It's a very human thing. But to be honest about feeling intimidated after people go after you, suggesting you might be, that you might have some emotional weaknesses, is even braver. So I think you're absolutely right. The other thing I want to completely underscore that you've already said, Renato, was, you know, I, like you, thought, well, listen, this is, she obviously gives us a context to what we're trying to understand in the impeachment process, but she is not the direct witness. So in that sense, that as we knew that the Republicans were going to go after, but you weren't in these conversations. You weren't there on July 10th. You weren't there on July 25th or July 26th, you know, any of these key dates that Congress is investigating to better understand Donald Trump's state of mind, what he may have said, what in fact happened. She was not the person who's going to be able to answer those questions. So, of course, understandably, we just didn't know how much interest there would be. And I, like you, I think thought it was going to be an important but simple day. I didn't think it was going to be unimportant, but I thought it was going to be pretty straightforward and simple. It became a lot more complicated.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, an effective way of dealing with their testimony would have been for the Republicans to do, I mean, certainly for the most part, they were not trying to attack her personally. And just to say, okay, well, you didn't see this, you didn't do that, you know, you weren't a witness to this. And there was some questioning along those lines. And, you know, if they stuck to that, you know, that would be effective. If this was a criminal trial, you know, I would have gotten up and I would have done less than 5 minutes of questioning total for this witness if I was on the defense, you know, the defense lawyer here. Just said, you know, just kind of explore the what I'll call the limits of her knowledge, what she didn't see, what she didn't hear, what she didn't know. And I'd sit down.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because in fact, as the questioning continued, it just gave her more. It gave her the opportunity, especially as counsel for the Republican side, asking open-ended questions that enabled her to underscore just how not normal all this was, just how outside of the way that modern diplomacy works, the way that U.S. national policy was formulated, and how outside of all of this that was, which, while she couldn't be a fact witness on any of those kind of key dates and key conversations, she certainly was an expert witness on U.S. policy, the national security interests of the country, and that everything, and gave her more opportunity to talk about what was being told to her about Rudy Giuliani's role with someone, a former prosecutor general of the Ukraine, that she knew to be someone who was not prosecuting corruption. So that, yeah, that enabled her to more deeply establish what she was credible on and what is, I think, germane to the impeachment process. And to your point, not something that as a defense lawyer, you would want to give the witness opportunity to expound upon.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, you know, the Republicans, you know, in one sense, there's a kind of standard playbook that is going on here, which is if the evidence isn't going your way, you try to distract or confuse the issues, which is, I think, a fairly commonplace defense strategy when you don't have, when the evidence isn't going your way. When it is, you obviously highlight the, you know, the evidence that helps you or the issues with the evidence. But, you know, they have not executed that plan very well. It's just been very ham-handed. And, you know, obviously Trump himself is a real impediment to that. I mean, to me, the biggest Trump's greatest enemy is himself, not only with that tweet today, but refusing to admit any kind of wrongdoing. I mean, I think a different human being, if Donald Trump was a different human being than he is, he would have before all this said, you know, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have got Giuliani involved in foreign policy. I shouldn't have done that. And, you know, I probably should have released the aid right away. And I screwed up, but that's not an impeachable offense or, you know, something like that. Kind of tried to take the wind out of the sails of some of this. But by sticking to his guns, by admitting no fault, by forcing the Republicans to just, you know, sort of try to create a circus to distract from the obvious, which is that there was a quid pro quo here or bribery, whatever you want to call it, and we can get to that issue later. I think that's ultimately really hurt the Republicans.
Well, I think that's right. I think, as we know, it's not in Donald Trump's personality to ever admit fault or weakness or any mistake. It also, as the evidence has come out, has become, even if he did that, there's the striking thing about the end of the last week, which is going to make this week even more important, is Donald, sorry, I'm blanking on his name. Is it David Hines?
Oh, sure. You're talking about the aide. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The aide.
Who overheard the call.
Right. Who overheard this incredibly damaging call sitting in Kyiv with Sondland, who overhearing a conversation with Donald Trump. And that is so pivotal because the only thing that the Republicans have been able to say is, you didn't have a conversation with the president. You don't know what the president said beyond the call summary. You know.
Yeah, right.
But in whatever is being transmitted to Sondland or Volker or Giuliani or Perry or Mulvaney, you don't know what he has said. In other words, they're still plausible. They argue, I think the call summary is a different, makes a counterpoint, but they can certainly argue more effectively that no one has demonstrated how Donald Trump was directly somehow more interested in getting dirt that helped him in his election versus something bigger, right? Like corruption
broadly.
Exactly. Because that's the argument they're making about the call summary. Doesn't read that way to me, but that's the argument I would make if I were in their shoes. But this conversation takes that off the table. And so if Donald Sondland comes in this week and, you know, is he going to deny that conversation happened? We've heard there are two other witnesses. So if it did happen and he denies it, he could very well be in even more legal jeopardy than he may be now. But if he admits to it, then Donald Trump's in even deeper trouble. It's going to be a very interesting week.
Yeah, for sure. And his name, I just looked it up, is David Holmes.
David Holmes.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I agree with you, Maya, that Gordon Sondland's testimony to me is, at least unless some other witness comes out of the woodwork, right? You know, somebody like Bolton or Mulvaney just decides to take the stand, which it does not appear likely. It seems out of the witnesses that we expect to receive, that Sondland's testimony is going to be the most weighty. And it's partly because of this issue you raised. I mean, the Republicans have, I think, effectively pointed out that certain people are not don't have direct contact with Trump. But Mr. Sondland does. He was on the phone with Trump talking about these issues. So I've always thought that was an interesting argument on their part, because you're going to hear from the guy this week. Now, I was going to tell you, yeah, I was on a phone with Trump discussing these matters. But, you know, what I would say about Sondland's testimony, when I've read it as a whole, is he seems to me like a guy who's torn between two things. One is he very much wants to have good standing with Trump and the Trump world. You know, he's a guy who donated $1 million to the Trump inauguration. He's a hotel mogul type guy himself. But at the same, and so he's trying to spin things as best as he can. But he has a sense of shame. He's not shameless like someone like Corey Lewandowski. He cares enough about his own reputation that he's not going to go in there and just baldly lie or do something crazy. And so he's trying to defend the indefensible as best he can or try to put the best possible spin on it, which means that at times he will say things that are harmful to Trump. And I actually think that that makes his testimony more believable because it's clear that he's in the bag for Trump, but nonetheless is saying things that are harmful to him.
I think, yes. I think the question becomes, is he going to continue to be more honest in order to make it clear that he is not perjuring himself? Because, yeah, you know, he is in a complicated position now. And I think he, one, did the right thing when he amended his testimony, because he clearly was not telling the truth in that completely in that first testimony. But leaving out the July 26th conversation, I mean, is he going to keep saying he just didn't remember? I think it'll be interesting to see how he talks about that and how forthcoming he is. And is he going to do a Kurt Volker? I mean, Kurt Volker also is in an interesting position this week when he testifies, because again, you know, Kurt Volker was another person who was suggesting, oh yes, you know, all these things were troubling, but we were holding the line on U.S. policy was to support Ukraine and that they needed the military aid, almost as a saying, so therefore this isn't really that troubling, you know, going back to this isn't really impeachable argument. But that just doesn't hold water as we get more of the facts and details around these transactions. And just imagine if we could actually get the documents from OMB, from the State Department, from the Department of Defense, all of whom have documents, texts, emails, who knows what else, that are relevant to tell us much more clearly and paint a much more unequivocal picture about what was really swirling around these various conversations, because everything we've been learning in the past week just makes it a much harder climb for Republicans to defend this behavior as if it's just wrong, not impeachable.
Yeah, I think it is going to be hard, although it's interesting because I think there's a division among Republicans. I think a lot of the smart ones want to take that line, it's wrong but not impeachable, but Trump has made it hard, and others are sort of trying to defend, you know, what Trump did, yep, on the merits. I will say that you know, my read on Sondland and the situation there is as follows, and I think this is going to answer some of our listener questions because I did pay close attention to those. You know, a lot of people are asking sort of questions about whether Sondland's going to get prosecuted and things like that. I will just say, if I was advising Sondland, I wouldn't be that concerned as a practical matter. I mean, I guess even a small chance of getting prosecuted for a felony is an extreme concern to a rich, powerful person like Mr. Sondland. So you don't want to even open yourself up to any opportunity of that. But I don't think as a practical matter he's likely to actually get prosecuted. But I do think, you know, not aside from just, you know, the creating the chance of that, I think there's just an appearance issue for him. He doesn't want to look like some sort of stooge. He appears to me like a guy who cares about his reputation. And so, you know, he said, okay, my recollection's been refreshed. I suddenly have this refreshed memory. And I guess what I see is, like, for example, regarding this call that Mr. Holmes overheard, I would think he's going to say one of two things. Either he's going to say, you know, I just don't remember it. That may have happened, but I just don't recall it. So he's not going to contradict them, but just say, I don't remember it right now. Or he's going to have a suddenly refreshed memory again, right?
Yep.
And
yep.
Either way is, I don't know how much that moves the ball forward for Trump, either way.
Yeah, no, I think to your point, I agree with you, and I think that's why Sondland, it's so important for him to be very forthcoming and to stop trying to game the testimony and walk some tightrope and just tell it like it is, because that's why we have the threat of perjury indictments, right?
Sure.
It's in order to convince people to tell the truth. And so when they become in danger of perjury, that becomes the lever for investigators to say, you really want to make sure you correct this testimony if it's not honest and accurate. And I think this is another week like that for him. And that is the purpose of the statute, right? Is to convince people to tell the truth, not to just run around trapping people and prosecuting them. And I think it's important for the audience to understand that, that is the goal of having that kind of criminal statute. But I do think in order for him to do exactly what you're saying, Renato, which is to take care of his reputation, it's time to just tell it. You know, I'm trying to figure out how to stay in the good graces of the Republican Party or Donald Trump, and provide some protection, rather than doing what we heard the witnesses this week do, which was take a nonpartisan, fact-based approach. Just tell it like they experienced it and just be factual. And when they didn't know something, I think every witness this past week did the right thing in saying, I don't know, I can't answer that. I wasn't there. That's not, you know, that's the kind of thing that I think the American public needs to see and hear, is witnesses who are just trying to give the facts, not spin them.
Yeah, I will say, you know, it's an interesting thing about the world in which we live in right now, that being very straight and calling it like he sees it, it pretty much guarantees Mr. Sondland that he'll be attacked on Fox News, that Donald Trump's going to tweet about him, that he's going to be called a never-Trumper or whatever their pejorative of the day is. And he'll be ostracized because it's not about truth. It's about a kind of a tribalism of, like, which side are you on? And if he's not on Trump's side, he's dead to these people. And I think, you know, it kind of dovetails with our conversation earlier about that tweet to the ambassador, Ambassador Yovanovitch, is that, you know, that's the purpose really of the Trump tweets and of the haranguing of these witnesses.
Yeah, and I think this is why this is an impeachment process, right? I think another thing you and I have talked about is what it means to be prosecuting abuse of power as an impeachment process, right? Not as a criminal trial. This is not a criminal prosecution. This is the most powerful person in the world, let alone in the country, using the office for personal gain, and in doing so, keeping everybody else quiet about it because they have the power of that bully pulpit. And that's why abuse of power is impeachable. And it, now obviously that means it has to be measured against the Constitution's clear balancing of power and trying to make clear that, you know, we don't want to supplant elections for partisanship, but that's why it is an abuse of power lens. How bad is this abuse of power? That's why I think some Republicans are starting to recognize the facts are so bad here. We can't dodge the fact that there's a problem. We just have to argue that it's not at that level. But this level, every time Trump does what he does, which is demonstrate, I will use this office, I will use the power to bully people into silence. Why we have whistleblower statutes is so that people do not feel bullied into silence and can blow the whistle if they see violations of law or waste, fraud, and abuse. This is exactly why we have these kinds of protections. And the more he uses that bully pulpit and the more it works, the more endangered our Constitution is.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the whistleblower status, and we had a question about that this week from one of our listeners. About what could be done if somebody's trying to out the whistleblower. You know, my take, I took a look at that issue. And something I discussed it in length for our Patreon newsletter and a podcast. And it looks to me like there's no enforcement mechanism.
Yeah.
That, in other words, if there's really nothing that could be done legally if members of Congress, for example, start trying out the whistleblower.
Yeah, I think this is a real example of the American public learning about our laws and how they work and how they're deficient. Because I think the common understanding is, oh, whistleblowers are protected. Well, whistleblowers are protected, as you know, Renato, but in terms of their employment.
Correct.
In terms of their employment, they don't have any other forms of protection. And national security witnesses, as we know, is even a more unique animal because of the issue of protecting classified information. So even the notion that, as we saw in the debate about whether Congress gets the whistleblower complaint, which really they obviously should have gotten, but there's always been this fight between the executive branch and the legislative branch about the degree to which they could directly receive that classified information. So that's why we have this process where a whistleblower in the national security community has to go through the inspector general's office, and then the inspector general has to go, you know, up the chain in order to get it to Congress. But that there are no other protections built in for whistleblowers in terms of their identity if someone on Capitol Hill were to out them. And unfortunately, that in this context, that is exactly why we have some folks not coming forward, because they recognize that there aren't sufficient protections for them in an administration that has made clear in the form of Donald Trump himself personally that it will act and it will retaliate. It just may not do it in a way that is unlawful. And that's very dangerous.
Yeah, I think if there's one theme that's run through a lot of the questions that I've received over the past few years and some of the comments that I've had to make in response, it's that people have this assumption that when you do something wrong, that there's some person there to lock you up and throw you in prison. And that's not the way the law often works. And so people have, unfortunately, the public is starting to learn that, as you point out. One issue I do want to talk to you about is there's been a lot of discussion about hearsay this week, which is kind of interesting. You know, I spent a lot of my time, I spent a lot of my legal career mastering the federal rules of evidence, because you have to if you try cases. It's rare that anyone besides me and other people in the courtroom with me care about the federal rules of evidence. But the Republicans are making a lot of arguments about hearsay this week. What I would say about that is that, you know, first of all, well, hearsay, just to explain, well, why don't you explain what hearsay is, and we can kind of talk about, well, I'm curious what you think of the arguments, too. Maybe I should have you explain it, because you know as well as I do.
Well, I wanted to hear you explain it, but I mean, the bottom line is, you know, the reliability of what the statements are, which in a court of law means we want to hear from the person who made them so that we know they're reliable. And so usually it means you can't say he said, she said. And then, of course, we have the, you know, you had Devin Nunes talking about fourth degree of hearsay, which is like how many people did this statement go through?
Sure.
You know, but as you know, you probably have some great stories about the exceptions to hearsay. And when you are able under the exceptions that exist in the federal rules of evidence that allows hearsay. And, you know, I think people need to understand that the issue is the degree to which you can rely upon what you're being told someone said. And I just think that's important to hold here as Republicans are throwing hearsay into this without any real analysis of, are we able to understand the reliability of what we're hearing versus whether we're hearing it directly from the person who said it? And in this instance, where we have so many people who are saying the same things over and over and over again, you know, just speaks volumes in and of itself. And of course, you know, when we get into this call on July 26th, where we're going to have witnesses who overheard parts of the call, or where Sondland, in the heat of that moment, gave his sense of what the president was thinking and feeling. Like, all of those are the kinds of things, you know, many of us would be arguing would come in as yep. evidence. And I think that is important. I do want to make one other point about this, because I do want to hear what you think about the hearsay argument. But I just have to say this, because, you know, I think we've been rightly and understandably talking about criminal law so much during this process. But the fact is, this is not a criminal proceeding. And it is a critically important proceeding. And most presidents, including Richard Nixon, the fundamental foundation of his impeachment was abuse of power. The fact that there was a Watergate break-in and therefore a crime, it did not change that most of the articles of impeachment were about abuse of power. The same is true for Andrew Johnson. So I think we forget that it's Congress that decides what evidence is sufficient, credible, reliable, and therefore provides grounds for impeachment.
Yeah, I would say I agree with you 100% that this is not a court proceeding. The rules of evidence don't apply. I think that's also, and we could talk a little bit about the whole bribery issue later. You know, it's a thing people should keep in mind. I think that all too often we spend a lot of time arguing about legalisms that don't actually matter for purposes of this. But to get back to the point of hearsay, I'll just explain for listeners what hearsay means. I mean, one way, I personally think that the Republican argument on this point has largely been ineffective. I think it's fine when they say, well, this person didn't talk to Trump or didn't see, you know, they didn't speak directly to Trump. Okay, I think people can get their head around that. And it's actually a fair point in certain contexts. But the whole hearsay thing, I don't even think the average person really knows what hearsay means. I mean, what hearsay is under the law, it probably has a different meaning than it does in common speak. But what it means is that all it is it's not a firsthand account. So in other words, if I, you know, Michael Cohen can say, you know, in terms of here, you know, directly, I, you know, I witnessed Donald Trump do this. I witnessed him, you know, speak with Stormy Daniels or something like that. He's talking about what he saw, what he heard, right? And that's direct evidence. That's not hearsay. A bank record is hearsay because a bank record is just some piece of paper that contains numbers and letters and things on it. But it's not all these documents, which we often consider very reliable, are technically hearsay under the federal rules of evidence. And there has to be an exception. And there is, of course, an exception for records of regularly conducted activity, often called the business records exception, that would allow that business record to come in if there's certain testimony supporting the bank record. But the reason I use those examples are that, you know, you were talking, Maya, a moment ago about what matters as reliability. And most of us would trust the records of, you know, a bank, a Chase Bank or something, then we would trust Michael Cohen's word, not say so on something. And, you know, even though Michael Cohen's testimony in this context would be direct evidence, whereas the other one would be hearsay, you know, more traditionally, hearsay is when another person says, I heard someone else say this, right? That's what I think is the kind of the paradigm or the what comes to mind when we think of hearsay legally. And in this context, like that phone call where Trump is speaking over the phone, that's technically, you would think that's hearsay. The difference here, though, is that because Donald Trump is the person who's the object of this impeachment inquiry, even if this was a criminal proceeding, that would come in as evidence as non-hearsay because it would be the statement of the party opponent in the case. The Democrats would be able to offer that testimony on that basis alone as non-hearsay. It's one of many exceptions to the hearsay rule. I guess, you know, my bottom line is I don't think any of this matters. And I think what matters, as you point out, Maya, is how reliable and persuasive the testimony is.
Yeah, I think that one of the reasons why Republicans are using hearsay so actively is less for the broad American public and much more for the base. And so it's less about facts, it's less about reliability, and it's more about just don't listen to this.
Sure. I think it's just more distraction and trying to provide, you know, they don't have a lot to talk about here. The facts are very damning on their face. There's clearly proof of this, you know, scheme, aid for an announcement, announcement of investigation. That scheme is pretty well established. I think it's going to be hard to deny by the time this is over. And so there's just all this circus around it. Let's just talk for a moment. People on the podcast have heard me discuss before whether, you know, this should be how we should call, what we should call this whole thing. I know it's something you and I have discussed privately.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my view on this has always been, you know, I'm concerned about the use of the term bribery, which the speaker used this week, because I was concerned that it would allow the sort of discussion of technical legal arguments about whether it's technically bribery, which can be a challenging thing to prove in a criminal case, which is irrelevant to this proceeding. I mean, it's not, as you point out, it's not a criminal case. This is, the abuse of power here is clear. But I will say, though, you know, a CNN anchor, when I was on, mentioned to me there on the air, said that there's some sort of focus group that found that bribery was more effective, or the Democrats had a focus group. I will say, as you know, we use jury consultants sometimes as litigators. If a focus group told me that was the effective phrase, I probably would use that too. I worry, though, about sort of arguments about the legal technicalities here.
Yeah, and you know, I agree. I've been very concerned about the same thing, and including the suggestion that something's only impeachable if it's indictable.
Right.
I think that flies in the face of the history of impeachment proceedings we've had, and really ignores what the founding fathers, including Hamilton and Federalist Paper number 26, where he was quite eloquent about this impeachment being about protecting the public from abuse of power. And the founders really did liken it to, you know, trying to ensure that we were not turning into a monarchy. And so that's not about whether it was bribery or not bribery or extortion. But at the same time, I think part of what's happening, of course, politically is bribery is an explicit term in the Constitution. And to the extent there's this debate about what did the founding fathers mean by high crimes and misdemeanors, there are some very good scholarly pieces written that make it clear that they really were thinking about people doing the job in such a dangerous fashion that they should be removed, not just whether it's a legal crime. But it's also, you know, this the political moment we're in, where there's this feeling that you have to articulate an indictable crime, and that may be both an unfortunate, you know, casualty of the Mueller probe, which, you know, focused very exclusively, because it was a special prosecutor, on whether or not crimes were committed and whether there was sufficient evidence of crime. And remember, as you and I both know, Robert Mueller didn't say there wasn't evidence of crime when it came to conspiracy with Russia. He said because of people lying and destroying evidence, that they couldn't find sufficient evidence. And that's an important distinction. But it's gotten us into this kind of trap about whether or not, in fact, there is an indictable crime. And that's why I keep going back to personal gain, because the one thing that is useful about terms like bribery, extortion, is folks' general sense of what are we talking about in terms of how this happened. You know, this that Donald Trump really had something that the Ukrainians desperately needed. And they desperately needed it because they're in an active and hot war with Russia. And so it really, and why it was so important to us as a nation that they get that support, both their photo op with him in a meeting with the new anti-corruption administration to send a message to Moscow, as well as the military aid. So I think this is why people can understand that the primary issue here, bribery, extortion, it's all about abusing power for personal gain, right? That's all it is.
I like that phrase better because I think it's more accurate. What I always worry about, it, I will say, is that, you know, and this is give people insight into how I try cases as a criminal defense attorney is, regardless of the technical elements of a crime, people have in their minds what a crime should look like, right? So, you know, I had obtained an acquittal in a conspiracy case, part because the jury thought a criminal conspiracy has got to be way more nefarious than what had happened in that particular case. And I think here people think of bribery like money, you know, there's some like cash that's given in exchange for something or whatever. And I think if I was a member of Congress trying to explain this to people, I would be explaining it in terms of, as you point out, this is an abuse of power to get something for his own gain. And, you know, because it's not cash, but it's something that mattered for him politically. And that's what this is really all about.
Yep. A thing of value.
Yes, it certainly mattered to him.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, one issue I will say that I was surprised at the number of questions from listeners on, and is what will happen when we go to the Senate? I think a lot of people are concerned that there won't even be a Senate trial at all, that McConnell's not going to take it up, or that that's going to turn into a complete circus. You know, as it seemed to me from what I've heard in the news, it seems like that McConnell has conceded that there's going to have to be a trial if this gets sent over from the House. So there will be some sort of proceeding, but we don't really know what that's going to look like, do we?
We don't. And you're absolutely right that there's, and understandably, people are concerned about Mitch McConnell as the senator who denied a sitting president his constitutional right to have a hearing for his Supreme Court nominee on the completely bogus argument that because Obama had one more year in office, he didn't get to nominate and have heard and have a hearing for a Supreme Court nominee. So that has people feeling like Mitch McConnell will game the rules to the benefit of Donald Trump. And so it's completely understandable. At the same time, Mitch McConnell, you know, heard and understood that the rules of the Senate do not allow him to refuse to have a trial. So then the question becomes, but what does the trial look like? And that is a really interesting question none of us can really answer now. I mean, remember, we've only had two trials of sitting presidents, right? Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton. And the Bill Clinton trial, you know, it's basically, you know, there was deposition testimony that was videotaped that folks heard. But that was because you had Bill Clinton had been a witness. He had a deposition testimony. And, you know, there's all with the obstruction of Congress, with not knowing what more witnesses are going to come forward, without knowing whether or not there's going to be any documentary evidence beyond what we already know about, you know, whether they're going to continue to be successful at stonewalling. We don't really know even what all the body of evidence is going to be, because even as we learned last week, more evidence keeps coming forward in the form of witnesses who are now testifying to things they saw and heard. So it's a little hard to know, because I don't think the Senate can know until till this process plays itself out, and until they see what all the evidence is, and until there are a full set of articles of impeachment and what all the articles are on. But I think what is true, unfortunately, unlike when Bill Clinton faced trial for an impeachment trial in the Senate, is we will not see a bipartisan effort by the majority leader and the minority leader in the Senate to figure out a way to have this be a credible process. That actually did happen in the Bill Clinton impeachment. There was still enough concern about the institution of the Senate that they should come up with a way to ensure that it does not become a dog and pony show, that it doesn't become a farce, that it has credibility, that it's balanced. And they did that, and that we will not see, unfortunately.
Without a doubt. Yeah, I would not be surprised if McConnell, you know, sharply limits the witnesses, says that they've already heard enough, you know, from certain witnesses and so forth. And I certainly, you know, that you've seen Rand Paul and Lindsey Graham and others have talked about calling certain witnesses. They want to call the whistleblower. They want to exclude all testimony that they deem to be hearsay. So I could see it turning into some sort of sham that will make it, you know, there'll be complaints by Democrats, but I think it will make it easier for, you know, Senate Republicans to just ignore strong evidence that was presented to the public via the House proceedings.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I agree.
Well, you know, one thing also that I will say is, you know, it does seem like, you know, I've thought for a while that this process is going to go at a very quick speed. It seems like this is the House is really going to get this to, you know, done and to the Senate, you know, at least by the end of the year. Does it appear that way to you as well?
Yeah, it does. They're moving so quickly. I think the only thing that might derail that is more witnesses continue to come forward that are clearly important witnesses. So if they're still discovering that there are people who have more direct knowledge, they are going to have to, I think, even though there's tons of evidence right now, I think they do need that if it continues to come forward, and they will, I have no doubt they'll work weekends if they have to. But it's, you know, they're also concerned about both the appearance of trying to interfere in an election process, presidential election process, but they're also this on the Senate side. You know, obviously, Democrats are deeply concerned with how it's going to impact sitting senators who also need to be on the campaign trail. So there are all kinds of factors flying around this. But I think the most important for all of us is getting the most facts that we can so that the American public, not just Congress, but the American public can understand what happened.
Yeah. I will say, you know, it's been interesting to see the comments that were left by listeners who were interested in, you know, getting quite, you know, asking us questions. And a lot of people were like, can we hurry this up? And then there are other people saying, there's other people like, let's include every offense he may have committed. Let's, you know, do a look at emoluments and let's look at obstruction and all these other things. And I think, you know, Democrats are in a spot where they're trying to get this done before the holiday, and they really want to do that because the Iowa caucuses are right around the corner, and I think it's important for them to sort of reduce the argument that Republicans are going to make that we should just let the election decide these issues.
Yeah, and I think that the part of this that is really hard for Democrats is what happened with the Mueller report, where the feeling was, you know, part of the issue there is there were bombshells in that report, including on obstruction. And because it was so dense and because there was so much in it and because it was hard for the American public to really get a sense of, and so poisoned, of course, by the misleading summary of the report that William Barr shamefully put out, rather than doing what Robert Mueller had intended, which was just release those summaries of each section. That, you know, I'm assuming, I don't have personal knowledge of this, but they're also gun shy about making the story too much to follow and feeding the argument that they're just trying to do whatever they can to get Donald Trump rather than focusing on what all Americans can understand to be deeply problematic for the country. So I have sympathy certainly for all the positions, because I think there is so much evidence of wrongdoing by Donald Trump. And I personally have said that because of the obstruction of Congress, completely shocking and astounding obstruction. I mean, no other president has gone to the lengths of this president to block Congress from information it constitutionally has a right to. I mean, usually there's bickering over how many documents and whether there's some that can be withheld. Not you can't get any, and you can't talk to anybody. I mean, that's including, remember, Corey Lewandowski, people who didn't even work for the White House. I mean, that's exactly. It's just been shocking. But given the pattern of obstruction here, and given the obstruction and the pattern of obstruction that was clearly laid out with evidence in the Mueller report, you know, it does seem that somehow Congress needs to get obstruction clearly and aggressively in the articles of impeachment, and that, you know, it may be worth pulling in the evidence from the Mueller report to show the pattern of behavior. That this isn't that part of what makes it so impeachable is it's a pattern of behavior denying constitutional oversight to Congress, but also obstructing justice, and that which is what's happening right now. And so I think that there is an argument for some expansion, but not because it's taking on everything, but because it's so central to what we're seeing around what is the Ukraine scandal, which is active obstruction, including from lawyers who work for the public. It's just unnerving.
It is. I will say, you know, there is definitely a connection here between Mueller and the Mueller situation in this, you know, particularly given that Mueller testified the day before Trump's call with the Ukrainian president, and Trump mentions it in the call and, you know, criticizes Mueller in the call. You know, I will say, you know, there's trial lawyers can be all over the map on this. I know there's some people who, particularly prosecutors, who feel like, well, they have such a high burden, they want to throw everything into the case that they can, overwhelm the other side.
Mm-hmm.
I'm of the belief, and it's been my experience, that keeping the story simple is the key to victory, particularly in a complex case. I've tried a lot of very complex cases, and I think the person with the simple story usually wins in a trial. So I'm sympathetic to what the Democrats are trying to do here, and I think there's some definite political realities. But I think, you know, one thing that they have that's a tension coming up is the more time they take to present witnesses and go through this, the more that this might be able to break through with the public. But of course, they have, you know, political realities in terms of the schedule, which we already discussed. And, you know, I was going to sort of close by asking you what we should be looking forward to, and what you think, how you think listeners should be, you know, making sense of what they're going to be hearing in this upcoming week. And I have to say, Maya, it's going to be challenging because there's just so much going on this week. Mm-hmm. It's a lot to throw at the public at once.
It is a lot. I think that the way I think about it is I listen to key dates, you know, May 23rd, July 10th, July 25 and 26, and then the few dates in September. You know, in other words, these critical points where, because it was in May, clearly in May, April, May, that the Trump administration started shifting away from what was the bipartisan agreement about what the national security interests of the country were, which is getting money and support to this new administration in the Ukraine that was going to fight corruption. You know, what happened around those pivotal dates where that clearly shifted? July 10th and July 18th, you know, these dates where it's now becoming very clear that there is this effort to withhold money and aid from Ukraine in exchange for these investigations on the Bidens. And then, you know, and then as we move through into, and of course the call, and now this July 26th has become a critical date, because July 26th, now we know there's been a conversation, Gordon Sondland, with President Trump that people overheard that go directly to his intent and state of mind. and then of course September and this shift and aid now getting freed up. So I think of them in those kind of date timelines, of these big kind of bright timeline bullet points where witnesses adding information around those are what I pay attention to. And that's why, as we were saying early, Sondland on July 26th, what's he going to say about that? And what's he going to, and he corrected his testimony around those September dates. What's he really going to say about that? And he did have direct conversations with Donald Trump. What more is he going to say about those direct conversations? And same for Kurt Volker. So I think of it around those key points in time.
I think that's a good roadmap for the testimony to come. And I really appreciate you coming on. It's been a real pleasure. I always learn a lot and enjoy speaking with you. So thank you so much, Maya.
Thank you, Renato. You've been such a clear, consistent, and educating voice. I appreciate you very much.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of On Topic. Please subscribe to this podcast, go to your app and review the podcast, and join us for our next episode. I'm Renato Mariotti. Until next time, let's stay on topic.